Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The new film Coraline takes viewers into a magical and sinister world, where a plucky young girl struggles to make her parents notice her. Then she discovers a secret passageway to an alternate family filled with enchanted singing, delicious food, and attentive parents. But that beautiful world quickly unravels, which is when director Henry Selick really starts to have fun. This hour On Point, Henry Selick on his new film, Coraline. You can join our conversation. Have you seen the film, Coraline? What did you make of it? Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is writer, director, and producer Henry Selick. He directed The Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach. His new film is Coraline, which the Los Angeles Times called a remarkable feat of imagination, a magical tale with a genuinely sinister edge. Henry Selick, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Jane.
Thank you. Begin by giving us a summary of Coraline.
Coraline's the story of a young girl who moves into this house. It's divided up into apartments. She doesn't like the neighbors. Her parents are much too busy for her, and she's bored out of her skull. She discovers a secret doorway, which leads her to an alternate version of her life, where everything seems similar, but better. There's gifts for her, time for her, great meals, and magic. Ultimately, it's an Alice in Wonderland meets Hansel and Gretel tale with a terrible promise of what's to come that she discovers on the other side.
Let's listen to a bit of the film. Here first is Coraline, played by Dakota Fanning. As you mentioned, she's just moved with her parents into that old pink Victorian. And her mother, played by Terry Hatcher, is typing on the computer, finishing up a gardening catalog.
So, can I go out? I think it's perfect weather for gardening.
No, Coraline, rain makes mud. Mud makes a mess.
Mom, I want stuff growing when my friends come to visit. Isn't that why we moved here?
Something like that. But then we had the accident.
It wasn't my fault you hit that truck.
I never said it was.
I can't believe it. You and Dad get paid to write about plants, and you hate dirt.
Coraline, I don't have time for you right now, and you still have unpacking to do. Lots of unpacking.
That sounds exciting.
This is a poor girl aching for attention, isn't she?
Yep. She's not getting any, though.
And the plot quickly turns, unsettling, shall we say. What draws you to these darker stories, Henry?
I think that there's just, I could say there's a little too much pablum in the world for kids, that kids... I do feel very connected to the childlike state of being. I have my own kids. They're drawn to the dark. They want balance. They, you know, there wouldn't be Halloween if they didn't like dressing up as monsters. There's, pardon me, supposed to hit that cough drop button. But I think that it's about balance, that kids really do have great imaginations, and it's not always dreaming about a pony or ice cream. It's the darker things as well. So I think it's part of who we are, especially as children. And so I feel I'm sort of drawn to that as kids are, and looking for some balance in life and of children's stories.
The balance. Do you think that they're able to handle children, these sort of darker, more sinister worlds that you often create?
Well, those Grimm's fairy tales have been around with us for hundreds and hundreds of years, and I'm sure before then there was the tribal elder warning them about the saber-toothed tiger outside. So, yeah, they're cautionary tales, and whoever told them best became the great storytellers. Chills around the campfire. Very young children, This movie, Coraline, was always intended for 7, 8 and up. It's for brave children of all ages.
Here's another clip from the film. Here's Coraline slipping through a secret passage into the home of her other family for the first time, and here she meets her other mother, who, like her mother, is played by Terry Hatcher.
Mom? What are you doing here in the middle of the night?
You're just in time for supper, dear.
You're not my mother. My mother doesn't have buttons. Do you like them?
I'm your other mother, silly. Now go tell your other father that supper's ready. Well, go on.
He's in his study.
Tell us, Henry Selick, a little bit about the making of this movie. You are the preeminent practitioner of this so-called stop-motion animation, and Coraline is really the first 3D film to be made in this very labor-intensive, painstaking process that involves the frame-by-frame manipulation of these three-dimensional models. I was watching this and couldn't believe the time and effort and the mind-numbing operation that this must have been for you. Can you describe for us what goes into putting together a film like Coraline?
Certainly. To an outsider, it might appear mind-numbing, but if our minds went numb, the films wouldn't be that good. there's many, many steps. I will try to do a shorthand. You need a great story to justify all the work. This is based on Neil Gaiman's best-selling novel for young adults, Coraline, which came out in 2002. Great story. You go to a script. You know, I wrote the script, I did the adaptation, and you imagine the world and how it has to change from book to script. I set it in the U.S. where it had originally been in England because I was just more comfortable with American-style English. Mm. From the script, you do storyboards where you plan the whole movie with these sketches that describe every shot. It's sort of editing the film before you make it, and you get to try out all sorts of ideas, and it's low budget because you're just doing sketches and editing from the storyboards. You basically go into all the plans for the film to design sets, to design your characters, which can take a very long time. Eventually, you get out onto the stages with your characters. You've recorded your voices from your voice talent, so you know what words they're supposed to say. And ultimately, what we do is we move these little puppets. I have a Coraline right here, which is, she's 8 inches tall. We sort of repose them up to 24 times a second, and then when that's played back at speed, each frame captures one of these poses. It gives the illusion of life. Mm.
That is such intricate work. I was reading, in a good week, an animator might create 5 seconds of footage, an entire crew, maybe 2 minutes. Is that right?
That's right, although we had some of our superstar animators who could give us 7 seconds a week.
Which is why the film took, what, almost 2 years to create, 20 months?
Yeah, the actual shooting of it was just under 20 months of work, and then the total full dedication to making this film was about 3.5 years.
On 50 small sound stages up in Oregon where you are. Talk about the intricate work of actually changing facial expressions. I was fascinated to watch this and to read about this. The different versions of the face that get swapped in and out 24 times a second. It's remarkable throughout this film.
Yeah, we have this range of characters, and we approach facial animation two different ways. Traditionally, that you can have sort of this little metal skull underneath with a jaw that opens and closes, shifts around, and then little metal bits that can move lips and eyebrows. And over that, you put sort of a silicone skin and you fake hair and things like that. So that's a mechanical face. And it's one way to go. But what I prefer for lead characters, this goes back to ancient days. There was a guy named George Pal who created the Puppetoons back in the 1940s. And in order to get sort of a fuller range of expressions or even full body shape changes, he would do a completely new sculpture, something new. So then you fast forward to Nightmare Before Christmas, and Jack Skellington was basically a ping pong ball with a couple of holes in it. Every time he spoke, we would change his whole head. We'd pop on a new head for A-E-I-O-U, his smiles, his frowns, stretching the corners of his mouth. And it was you know, a challenging thing in hundreds of heads. But with Coraline, we wanted to make her even more expressive. So we divided her face. There's an invisible seam line that we painted out in post across the middle of her face through her eyes horizontally. And then we have hundreds of different eyebrow, individual sculpts of eyebrows, and then even more mouths for every possible, you know, every letter to say, every mood, pouting lips, skeptical faces. Everything she does, her range of expressiveness is created by substituting new faces, completely different sculpts.
And that expressiveness is in the middle of these larger scenes where, in many cases, characters are flying around the room. In the circus scene especially was just remarkable. How do you do that? What if you slip? What if you get one frame wrong?
It's not as bad as it might appear. Flying around, we used to have to use this stuff called spider wire, which is basically invisible to camera. But now we have, we just call it a rig, some kind of metal apparatus to hold a character if it's up in the air, and we paint that out digitally in post. If we make a mistake, it's okay. We're capturing digitally as we shoot the film. We're not using film anymore. We're capturing the images digitally. So if a puppet breaks its ankle, which they do, and falls over, it goes to the puppet hospital and is repaired and comes back. And then you have the last image that was taken, and you can flip between live and captured to line it back up. It's our animators get to sleep at night. In the olden days, Nightmare Before Christmas, they didn't.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking with writer and director and producer Henry Selick. He directed The Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach, and his new movie is called Coraline. I'd like to take a listen now to another clip from the film. Here's Coraline. She's sensing something is wrong with her other family, and especially her other mother.
I want to be with my real mom and dad. I want you to let me go.
Is that any way to talk to your mother?
You aren't my mother.
Apologize at once, Coraline.
No!
Henry Selick, at that point, the mother turns into a bit of a scary skeletal figure, which in the movie making, I'm sure, took a while as well. As we were hearing before the break, this stop motion animation that you produced in this film. Talk about computer animation generally. Do you ever fill in the gaps with computer animation in this film?
Actually, the mother turns into a very tall and hungry fashion model at that point.
Okay.
although there might not be that much difference than from that from what you were describing, she's becoming. Do we use computers to fill in the gaps? Pretty much no, that we do use a lot of modern technology and CG to support what is essentially a handmade film. If we're going to do a film like this, it's really not about shortcuts. Ultimately, it's okay. The essence of what we do is handmade. The artist touches what you see. And the minute you go to computer and use computer image, well, that's not going to be as unique or special or interesting. And, you know, Pixar and DreamWorks and Blue Sky are so far ahead of anyone else as far as doing CG. It would be pointless. We would lose the essence of what we do. So we use computer. We clean up images. We sometimes composite. We'll put in moving clouds. And we use computer to visualize some of these in-between shapes and so forth. But in the end, it's all real stuff that we see on the screen. For a metamorphosis like that, there's basically a series of one mother turning into another, about 15 different mothers that are changing, you know, one after the other to grow from one to the other.
The jumping mouse circus scene with 61 mice on the screen. There was no animation in that. That was all stop motion.
No CG in that. We use what we call cycles. So it is hundreds of mice, but they're all sort of there's trombone players, trumpet players, drummers, but they're hopping in sort of a rhythmic style. And in each case, it's like the George Powell Puppet Tunes. There's a complete mouse replacement, sometimes 6 to 8 different mice for one cycle of hopping. Mm. So, you know, basically they hook up and you just use them over and over again. But we have people substituting them. The choreography's worked out. And, again, this is one the producer – well, there was other producers said, well, this will be CG, of course, because that would make sense. And I said, but – doing anything by hand in movies doesn't really make sense. Let's try to keep it all real stuff. Hmm.
What does 3D bring to this film, Coraline, Henry Selick?
There's two things that shooting the film in 3D brings. And I would really encourage anyone who hasn't seen the film yet to go see it this week, if I might put in a plug, because it's our last week in 3D before the fabulous Jonas Brothers own all 3D screens in the world for their
bounced,
3D concert.
Right.
Yep, the lovely Jonas Brothers. Yeah. But who wouldn't want to get out of the way for them? 3D sort of, it's two things. One, it captures what we do. That if you were to visit us while we're making the film, you'd be astonished that there's all these little sets, miniature trees, houses, cars, and of course our puppets that are moved a frame at a time. And it's lovely to come and visit us while we're shooting because it's sort of an astonishing toy shop come to life. 3D captures that reality, which, you know, CG or drawn doesn't quite have. And then we also it's very much a part of this story. I was looking for my Wizard of Oz transition going from, you know, a black and white to color and Wizard of Oz. I thought I can use 3D to enhance the other world. I can make that feel deeper and richer and sort of draw the audience into that 3D space the way Coraline is drawn into it.
Well, the stop motion animation is one thing, but shooting it in 3D, I mean, as I was reading, you take a picture on these miniature sets. You take a little picture for the right eye, then you move the camera a preset distance to take another picture for the left eye. So that in and of itself is a difficult and time-consuming, painstaking process.
No? Yes, we're basically masochists, and we, you know what? When you're shooting 3D, it's basically the equivalent of your, you know, left eye, right eye. If you're shooting live action, then the lenses would be about as far apart as human eyes. But when you're shooting miniatures, which our whole world is, there's no cameras or lenses small enough to get that close. Mm. So we do have to shoot the left eye, right eye separately, and we got that to be an automated process with a computer-controlled model mover. So it ultimately just added a little extra time. The animator would pose the puppet, take the left eye, and then the camera shifts with the lens to the right eye.
What about the business calculation of shooting a 3D film? I mean, you mentioned only having 3 weeks to play in 3D theaters before they're turned over to the Jonas Brothers. Is it worth it in the end to make that calculation for all that cost and an additional effort?
I believe so. I don't think 3D should be used for every single film. I don't think Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler would have been a better actor if he was shot in 3D. But in our film, I think, you know, what we have is a modern fairy tale. I think it sort of really, really adds to the essence of this journey we ask the audience to go on. The 3 weeks, it's just this weird thing where many people thought, well, there's going to be a lot of 3D screens. We're going to create 3D content, and the content got ahead of the curve where there aren't quite as many digital theaters out there equipped with 3D. Down the road, there will, you know, initially there'll be a horrible home 3D version, which I'm against, but it's happening anyway. But down the road, there's an incredibly good home 3D system that I think people will embrace. And then we're hoping a film like this could be re-released, just as Nightmare Before Christmas was given a post 3D effect. It's not, you know, the real 3D that we've got, but they can put it out every year for a couple of weeks. We think that Coraline will have the same kind of staying power.
Those are the production elements. What about the commercial viability? Coraline's done pretty well. You grossed $35 million so far. Cost $60 million to make, though. Are you certain that the DVD sales with those production elements of the 3D included will yield enough to make up the difference?
The models say yes. And, you know, Nightmare, when it first came out, it wasn't a huge hit. But over the years, it's proven to be one of the greatest merchandising bonanzas ever for Disney. So we think stop motion has a staying power that the other, CG in particular, may not have. It's old-fashioned to begin with, so it doesn't really get any older. So it has a timeless quality that can bear repeated viewings, and that's where I think the economic model makes sense, that it is in repeated viewings and you know, DVDs and ultimately home 3D as well as special re-releases.
I've got to get some callers into this conversation, Henry Selick. So many are waiting. Let's go first to Savannah, Georgia, where Giles is on the line. Hi, Giles. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
First, I just want to say I absolutely love the film, and I love Nightmare Before Christmas. I've been to see Coraline a few times, and I always bring friends, and they all always walk out with the same comments, which I think are really interesting, and I kind of agree. They say, wow, this was amazing. I would never take a child to see this because it would have terrified me when I was younger. And then the second comment is completely unrelated. They say the end of the movie feels like a video game. Because it's fine to three eyes. I agree, absolutely. I love the movie, but I have a goddaughter, but I wouldn't take her to see it because I think it would scare her in the way that The Witches scared me when I was a kid. Now, The Nightmare Before Christmas I don't feel is nearly as scary, but this one I think is much, much scarier.
Giles, thank you. Henry Selick, does the movie merit a G rating?
No, it's PG. That's the rating it's received. It is parental guidance. We do feel it's small children, as I said, under seven. It's probably not appropriate for them, and it's really what your kid can handle. But we don't think it's any scarier than The Wizard of Oz, which, you know, I think we all remember when we first saw it was quite scary. But it also is part of why it's so memorable. You know, if you're scaring kids, and in the end your protagonist, a kid, beats evil, comes out okay, I think it's the reassurance that you get at the end of our film or similar films means a lot. So it's, again, it's a question of balance. And if you don't have kids yourself, Giles, you know, talk to some people who've brought their kids. I'd be curious to see what those kids have to say.
I was sitting next to two 10-year-olds in the theater, and the mother kept reaching over to say, are you okay? Are you okay? The little girl had her hand around her head the whole time, but she seemed to be surviving. What did your kids think? You have a 17-year-old and a 10-year-old, Henry?
Yeah, well, they're very used to this project since it's been going for years.
Yeah.
And they're kind of my sounding board, so there's certainly nothing that would be too scary for them at their ages and with what they've been exposed to. But, you know, I've been with audiences and I've seen the reaction, and usually it's the parents more scared for the kids than the other way around. That for the kids it's an adventure. And yes, it has big scares, but you know, it's an age appropriate sort of thing. PG means parents should think before they take little ones to this film.
Lauren is on the line now from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm kind of a radical father, and the one thing that struck me about the movie was that in the other world, Dad is more or less an enchanted pumpkin, and in the real world, he's not much better. He's kind of definitely in the vegetable class. And all the vibrancy in either world comes from the mother. Now, I took my 12-year-old daughter to see this, and I've sat through every kid's movie since Clark Clinton's first term. So I notice that's very much the prevailing theme in kids' movies, that really it's the mother-daughter dyad that's far more energetic and dynamic than the father-daughter dyad. And as a dad, you know, it's like I just spent $20 to see a movie and I'm being slighted.
Henry, was that the intention? Lauren, thank you so much.
You know, the main relationship in the book, which this is based on, which is a beautifully written book and a bestseller, is mother-daughter. I wasn't, you know, about to reinvent that. So it's honoring what the main relationship is. And, you know, yes, the father is a supporting character. Mom is the leader of the family on both sides of the fence, other world and real world. So there's no conscious effort to, you know, take away from Dad, but that's sort of, he's only a supporting character in this film.
Here's another call now from Williamsburg, Virginia. Andrew is on the line. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, thanks.
First, I wanted to compliment the director on an extraordinary adaptation of what must have been a difficult book and required the addition of a character, and I appreciate that. My question is, how do you treat a work that is, as you have on several occasions, treated works so childlike without falling into the trap of becoming childish? How do you draw that line when you're trying to design this land of imagination?
Andrew, thank you. Great question. Henry Selick?
Well, in James the Giant Peach and Coraline, both films are based on pre-existing material. And I think that Roald Dahl, creator of many, many great books for kids, as well as Neil Gaiman when he writes for kids, because he writes for his hipper, older audience as well as kids, it's really the same stories, and it's just the protagonists that whose ages are changed. So the stories themselves aren't childish. They're children in a world that might have magic and beauty and wonder, but it's also filled with some nasty adults, some terrifying things. So I think it's we just the age of the protagonists change, but we don't make little kids' stories. These are stories that could be for someone at any age. We happen to put children at the center of them.
Here's another call before our next break. Kelsey is in Methuen, Massachusetts. Hi, Kelsey. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I was very happy that you stayed very strict to the book, which was one of my favorites, and that the 3D really kind of made you not really jump back in your seat by things coming at you, but kind of put you there in the movie.
Kelsey, thanks. Henry, it really was the addition of the 3D really stuck out as an important element of this film.
Yeah, thanks for your reaction. We didn't want it to be a gimmick. We really wanted to invite the audience into the world we'd created and use 3D just to enhance the story.
Eve is calling now from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Eve. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm responding actually to the caller a few minutes ago who said I would never take kids to see it. I want to tell you that I'm a pediatric nurse, and I have two children, one of whom is autistic. And my son, who is 5 years old, is autistic, and he loves Nightmare Before Christmas. He loves The Corpse Bride, and he absolutely loved this movie. I can't thank you enough for allowing us as parents to make the decisions to be able to be there for our children, because I was ready to skedaddle. I mean, there were a couple times I was afraid, but we kept checking with the kids, and if the kids were good, then we were good. And to this day, he can't wait for it to come out on DVD, so please hurry with that.
Eve, thank you. What's next for you beyond this film, Henry Selick? Is it another stop-motion animation project?
I've actually had my hand in many of the different techniques, starting as a 2D animator, but having gotten into stop motion a long time ago, I've found that's really my favorite medium. I've even directed a CG short right before Coraline, a little film called Moon Girl, which is for very young kids. That the little ones really love it. It's given the opportunity, I will always do my filmmaking using stop motion. It's just what I'm drawn to. The culture of it is very exciting to me. There's all this activity. It's like going to art school and film school every day. So, you know, to an outsider, it seems slow and tedious. Actually, when you're in the belly of the beast, it's incredibly exciting to see all these wonders being created every day.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking with writer, director, and producer Henry Selick. He directed The Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach, his new film, spectacular work called Coraline. Let's go to a call up at the top here. Wallingford, Connecticut. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Mr. Selick, I haven't seen the movie yet. I am looking forward to seeing it. But I've long been an avid reader of Neil Gaiman's stuff. And so I'm curious, as I would be with any adaptation, what role, if any, did Neil play in working with you to develop the adaptation? And to what extent do you think it made a difference whether or not he was involved?
Mark, thank you.
At the very beginning, I was so much in awe of Neil as a writer that I was going to him constantly during the first draft of the screenplay. He didn't ask me to do this, and at the end of the day, that screenplay was terrible. It didn't work. It was too faithful to the book, and it didn't read like a movie. So what Neil basically told me, he encouraged me, go off, find your movie, and then come back. So with that permission, I basically went off. It took me almost a year to get a screenplay that really worked, and I made some changes. I had to get it to feel like the film I wanted to make, and it was a little shy in bringing it back to him because things had changed. But that was the screenplay he responded to, and my producer Bill Mechanic as well. So I learned with Neil that never to go with small things on a regular basis, but to create large bodies of work. So maybe it was all the character designs at once, the storyboards for a complete scene. I would do regular check-ins with him, and he was always encouraging. I would often have a couple of important notes, but always doable ones. And it was a wonderful collaboration, not too close, but just every few months, sort of a check-in with a good Dr. Neil.
Has he seen the film?
Oh yeah, he's seen the film. I when I finished it, I flew out to where he lives most of the time, which is Menominee, Wisconsin. I think it was 5 degrees, and his friends, family, including his family doctor, all came to a special screening just for those folks. And Neil's very pleased with the final film.
Here's another question about the book from David, who's in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, David. Welcome to the program with Henry Selick.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Hi.
The one question I had is, and going back to what the last caller said, you know, I'm a big fan of Neil Gaiman's as well as yours, and I was wondering if there are any aspects of the book that you would have liked to have reproduced for a movie but weren't able to for time or money.
David, thanks.
There's a really good scene in the book, and I tried to hold on to it to the very last moment in the film, but had to let it go, and it's when, before Coraline goes back to, you know, her real parents go looking for her and are trapped in this other world, causing Coraline, who barely escaped with her life, to have to go back and rescue them. And she tells this wonderful story to the cat, which is basically her guardian angel, or the cat that can speak of the other world. And it's this story of when she was almost stung to death by bees, and her parents rescued her, and they took the stings for her. It's very, very beautiful and important, and for the book, ultimately it just stopped the flow of the movie. So had to let it go.
You started work years ago, Henry Selick, at Disney, and I'm curious what it was like when you worked there and what you make of Disney films today, the big Disney blockbusters, Lion King, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, all those.
When I worked at Disney, it's a very long time ago, but it was the late 70s, early 80s, and I was with this incredible group of people. We didn't know that so much at the time, but I went to this school, CalArts, with Brad Bird, John Lasseter, John Musker, Tim Burton, and 10 other people who've gone on to make their mark in the film business. We thought we were going to go to Disney and make films like Fantasia and amazing things, but it was, when we got there, it was a changing of the guard. It was, you know, Walt Disney had been gone for 10 or 15 years. Some of his best animators were all gone. There's just a handful of the old guard teaching the new people like myself the techniques of what they'd learned. the films we made were not the greatest. It was just sort of this fallow period, and we were pretty frustrated at the time. But ultimately, looking back, we all learned incredible skills at storytelling, at drawing, at getting our ideas out clearly. But it took some time. And John Musker with Ron Clements in particular, John, who could stick it out through anything, sort of rose up first with Basil of Baker Street, but then The Little Mermaid, then Aladdin, to help, rebuild the studio into the powerhouse. And then, of course, Pixar came along and struck a deal and ultimately has joined forces. So this is I'd say the golden age of animation more than any other time in history.
Hmm. Here's an email that we received from Ruben, who says, I can hardly wait to see the film, Henry Selick. I was wondering about the selection of stories to be made into film, generally speaking. Do you read the stories and find them on your own, or is it something where stories are presented to you and you just pick the ones that strike you?
It can happen any number of ways. In this particular case, Neil Gaiman came to me. He knew of my work directing Nightmare Before Christmas for Tim Burton and really responded to that, and so just came to me directly. He has an agent who sent me his unpublished novel. I read it overnight, which I never do. I usually put things off as long as I can, but I read it overnight and immediately saw a potential there for a film. But sometimes it's something I find myself or an original story that gets developed. Any number of ways to find the best stories to make the films.
Back to the phones now. Joel is calling from Willington, Connecticut. Hi, Joel. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I just have a quick question. What's your relationship, Mr. Selick, with Tim Burton? How is it now? And do you think that you and Tim will get together for another stop animation film? Thank you.
Joel, thanks.
My relationship with him is good. I haven't seen him personally face to face for 2 years. He lives in England, but when we premiere Coraline over there in I think May 5th, I'm inviting Tim and his lovely wife Helena Bonham Carter to the premiere. I hope to see him there, and it's always possible we would work again together.
Here's a clip from that 1993 movie, Nightmare Before Christmas. The protagonist, Jack, the Pumpkin King, laments that scarring people year after year has left him yearning for something more. Here's that.
Oh, somewhere deep inside of these bones, an emptiness began to grow. There's something out there far from my home. I've never known.
Do you get attached to a film, Henry Selick? Do you let it go when it's done? Do you watch it again? I mean, how do you? What's your relationship with these movies that you make?
The movies themselves, you kind of burn out on. I mean, you work on them for such a long time. There's a few magic moments, like when the score, the music for the film is finally recorded with real instruments, and you put that up against picture. And then you get a chance to see it. It's like the first time, but it sort of fades, and it's simply, that's a huge amount of work. All I can see are the flaws. But what you never get tired of are the characters, the ones you put so much care and love into. And then eventually, with time, it took 5 years, though, for Nightmare to just enjoy the film and not think, well, we've got too many songs. Hmm. That scene is terrible. Over time, I think you find your way back to a purely affectionate state for the movies.
So interesting. Eve is calling now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Eve. Welcome to On Point with Henry Selick.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Mr. Selick, I love the movie. I'll see it again. I took it as a cautionary tale for parents. I run a parents program. And what I saw in it was that parents need to give their children more good attention, not just gloves, although giving Coraline the gloves at the end said that Mom was listening. I wonder what your message is to parents.
Eve, thanks. Was there a message, Henry?
Yeah, there's certainly a message that children ignored can get into a lot of trouble. It's and certainly, everybody everybody's kids, even if you're not well off financially, has electronic gear for children. They need FaceTime. They need to interact with parents. Of course, Neil would say, because he's so busy writing all the time, that his message is something a little different, and that would be that sometimes the people who give you all the attention in the world do not have your best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the people that barely have time to give you attention but pay for the shelter over your heads and the food in your bellies are the ones that love you best. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just him trying to justify why he's so busy, never sees his kids.
Okay, Ben is calling now from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ben. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Hi, sure.
Mrs. Selleck, huge fan of all of your films. Haven't seen this one yet, but my girlfriend and I are very excited to see it this weekend. My question is about Nightmare Before Christmas. I could ask you thousands of questions. I'll try to keep it short. I've heard rumors of a sequel where they might go to Easterland or things like that. I was wondering if there's any forward movement on something like that. And also, recently there was a CD release called Nightmare Revisited, where a bunch of larger popular acts took the soundtrack and redid it in their own styles. I was wondering if you had heard that or had anything to do with that at all, and what your thoughts are on that CD.
Ben, thanks. Henry?
Yeah, I thought Marilyn Manson's song on there was actually pretty funny and quite good. As far as sequels, it's come up many times. There's plenty of other holidays to invade. We thought Arbor Day might be a good one. Other things for Jack Skellington to take over. But, it'll really be up to Tim and now John Lasseter, who's former head of Pixar, creative head of Pixar, who's now head of all Disney Animation. It's in the air, but it has been for quite a while.
Here's another call from Anne, who is in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And hi, Mr. Selleck. I'm a huge fan of your films, especially Coraline. Definitely my favorite movie almost of all time. And, I'm just calling in regards to this discussion about whether or not the film is appropriate for children. And I think we're really underestimating, children here. The best stories are the ones where, you overcome a great evil. And, if we're sending out the message that, they too can overcome that, they too can be independent, then that's a wonderful thing. The best children's stories are the ones where they overcome the great evil, like the White Witch in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Anne, thank you. Henry?
Only that I concur that it's just sort of silly for us to pretend, especially in animated films, that they can really only live within these confining boundaries of safeness. We're our film is actually like the early Disney films, Snow White and Pinocchio. They have deep darks, and their characters overcome those. So I concur. I think that we're actually giving nutrition to kids when they see a film like ours. Provided, they're not too little, they're not kids who are too shy. It's like I had said at the beginning of this conversation, it's about balance, and I think we need that in kids' films.
Is it true, Henry Selleck, that you made the Pillsbury commercials back in the late 80s? Is that a vicious rumor, or is that the truth?
Yeah, it's true. Although the Doughboy had existed for many years before, but I directed 9 Pillsbury Doughboy commercials, and he arrived in this special locked suitcase with his, at the time, I think, had 12 different expressions. That's all he had. And so we sort of breathed new life into the little white guy. And actually from that group of people that gathered to make those commercials, they all became the supervisors under myself on Nightmare Before Christmas. So it was a good opportunity to build a small team that then went on to do features. And many of those very same animators worked with me on Coraline.
Mm, so they followed you over the years. How did you get started in the stop motion animation? I mean, how did you go from that to this moment, from James to Nightmare to now Coraline?
As a kid, I saw what a lot of kids would have seen in the 50s and 60s, But what seemed to capture my imagination the most was the work of Ray Harryhausen. He's known as sort of the master of stop motion. He created the monsters and creatures for many, many films, but there was this one in particular, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and also Jason and the Argonauts, that just grabbed a hold of me. When his characters, his creatures were brought to life, I had this sense that these things are real. I don't know how big they are. I don't know how this is being done. I don't know where this is being done. But it was both terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. You know, flash forward many, many years, I wasn't on the path to be an animator necessarily. I was doing a lot of all the arts, photography. I drew and painted all the time, sculpting, big interest in music and, as well as in physics. And it was seeing a short experimental animated film on public television one summer that I realized everything I'm interested in comes together in this one form. And then in experimenting in animation, first it was some cutout work I did. I gradually went into the third dimension and found that was the most satisfying. So it goes back to late 70s, film I did called Seepage, where I got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts while I was working at Disney. And Disney said, fine, take 2 days off a week, make your film, work here the other time. And during that, I did these two life-size puppets, life-size characters in stop motion, and I've been in love with it ever since.
Well, it is an extraordinary work of filmmaking, and I appreciate you coming here to tell us about it today. Henry Selick, thank you very much.
How cool to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Joining us from Portland, Oregon, Henry Selick. New film is Coraline. You can see a trailer of the movie at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.